Iran's Hezbollah movement launches fresh attacks on Israeli targets in retaliation for the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in Gaza. And people in Iran hold nationwide rallies to show solidarity with Palestinians and condemn Israel's massacre of civilians in Gaza. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. It's now the 43rd day since Israel launched its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, where children's distressing cries of pain are reverberating. Latest videos from a hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis show Palestinian kids suffering from injuries sustained during an Israeli airstrike. The bombardment of Khan Yunis has killed around 30 people, most of them children. In central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, six Palestinians lost their lives in an air attack on a home. Total death toll from relentless Israeli bombing and shelling is now at over 12,000. Women and children make up a majority of the victims. Hospitals have been one of the prime targets of regime airstrikes since October 7th. One of the hardest-hit health facilities is Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, hosting over 300 patients in addition to civilians taking shelter there. The Israeli military has now given an ultimatum to the medics there, patients, and displaced at the hospital to evacuate within an hour. The military wing of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says group has prepared itself for a long defensive in the face of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. The Al-Qassam Brigade says the longer Israel stays in Gaza, the heavier it will suffer. The spokesman Abu Obeida says the Al-Qassam fighters are chasing regime forces from street to street. According to Abu Obeida, Hamas fighters have destroyed 62 Israeli military vehicles in the past 4 days. He says this is besides destroying several buildings where Israeli soldiers were hiding. Spokesman said Hamas fighters killed at least 9 soldiers at one such site. Abu Bid also says Hamas fighters have fired a barrage of missiles deep into occupied territories, including Tel Aviv. Israeli forces are facing fierce resistance from Palestinian groups as the regime continues its ground operation inside Gaza. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it shot down an Israeli Hermes drone over the northern part of the occupied Palestinian territories. The group earlier said it struck 7 Israeli targets with what it called appropriate weapons and inflicted damage on them. An Israeli tank was also hit near the Brani barracks. The group said its attacks are in response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime shelled several areas in southern Lebanon. Area along the Lebanese southern border has witnessed exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and the Israeli regime forces since October 8th. That was a day after Palestinian resistance launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood against Israel. Several Israeli settlements in northern occupied territories have been evacuated due to Hezbollah attacks. 5 Palestinians killed and 2 injured near Nablus in the town of Balata by Israeli regime airstrike. As soon as we get this developed, we'll get out to you accordingly. Meanwhile, Iranians have held nationwide rallies in solidarity with Palestinians who are still under relentless Israeli attacks for weeks now. Thousands of people from all walks of life hit the streets of different cities and provinces expressing outrage at the ongoing Israeli bloodshed in Gaza. They waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans against the occupying Israeli regime and its Western backer, the U.S. in particular. The protesters also censured Tel Aviv for massacring innocent civilians and called for the regime to be taken to task for its crimes. Iranians have held several rallies since Israel launched its brutal war on the impoverished Palestinian territory nearly 1.5 months ago. Now joining us for more on the story is Mona Kandil from Ramallah and Saad Nimr, professor of political science from Brzezet University, also from occupied Ramallah. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. We'll start with our correspondent there, Mona. Hope you're safe, doing well. Yesterday there was an attack on Jenin. Apparently right now, breaking news, it's, I guess, time for the regime to focus on Nablus. What can you tell us?
That's right. Unfortunately, it seems it's the time now on the Nablus city and the refugee camp of Balata. After midnight, Israeli aircraft, let's say, carried out a strike on a building in the refugee camp of Balata. And this led to the killing of five Palestinians. What happened? First, Palestinians have thought it was a drone attack on the building, the headquarters of Fatah movement in Balata refugee camp. However, in the early hours of Saturday, it seems that it was a warcraft and not a drone, because it caused severe damage. It's not a simple explosion or a strike. The whole building had been destroyed. Five Palestinians who had been killed in Balata refugee camp and two others had been seriously wounded. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that its military and the security services have carried out an operation in the Balata refugee camp. They said their aircraft fired missiles at a building without mentioning what's the kind of this aircraft. But they revealed that they struck a Palestinian cell, as they said, and that they succeeded to kill at least one of those who had been murdered was a wanted Palestinian, a member of Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and that this Palestinian cell were planning to carry out anti-Israeli operations, of course, against the Israeli soldiers. In addition to those five Palestinians who had been killed, and of course we have to mention that following this this strike, Israeli forces raided the Balata refugee camp, destroyed the roads, caused damage in the refugee camp of Balata, and also destroyed a home. It's not a home for a Palestinian prisoner, not the home of a Palestinian martyr who carried out an operation. And of course, the family members of this home were not informed that their home would be destroyed. However, it was already empty and was destroyed by the Israeli forces. In addition to those five Palestinians who had been killed, Israeli forces raided Tobas area. Clashes erupted between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the Israeli soldiers murdered yet one more Palestinian there, and two Palestinians had been wounded. This means that the number of Palestinians who had been killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of its war on the Gaza Strip, only here in the occupied West Bank, they have killed 212 Palestinians in addition to thousands others had been wounded.
And Mona, it seems that the regime is not only pursuing resistance fighters in the occupied West Bank, but it seems activists, protesters, especially protest organizers, bloggers, and other voices of dissent.
Exactly. Today alone, we are speaking about 40 Palestinians had been arrested. And of course, not all of those who had been detained by the Israeli forces were Palestinian fighters or those members of the resistance groups or those, at the end of the day, holding arms. No. Many of those who were detained were Palestinian activists, people from all walks of life, children, women, university students, normal people, civilians. Many were detained for expressing their rejection of the war, of the genocide being carried out against the people of the Gaza Strip, and the Israeli military considers such statements as incitement against the Israeli regime and the Israeli soldiers. people had been detained on military checkpoints after the Israeli soldiers had checked their mobiles. They saw that those Palestinians were watching videos for the crimes being committed against the Gaza Strip, or even videos for the Palestinian resistance. They had been detained for what so-called, there's a new law had been adopted by the Israelis called consumption or consumption of materials that is considered terrorist materials against the Israeli regime. Today, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, over 2,850 Palestinians were detained since the 7th of October in the occupied West Bank, in addition to over 4,500 Palestinians had been already languishing in Israeli jails. The situation of the Palestinian prisoners is really hard and difficult, according to those who had been recently released. And at the end of the day, the Israeli military is not allowing lawyers to have contact or to visit those who had been recently detained. Many of those who had been recently detained are also being held under the so-called administrative detention without charge or trial, because at the end of the day, there are nothing against them. They are normal Palestinians rejecting the Israeli occupation, calling for their freedom and immediate ceasefire, immediate stop of the genocide being carried out against the brothers and sisters in the Gaza Strip.
And Mona, and I believe of those thousands that detained, a few have actually died in Israeli custody under very suspicious circumstances.
Exactly. Five Palestinian prisoners were killed in these jails. And let me say they had been killed. These were remarks made by the Commission of Prisoners Affairs and by the Prisoners Society. They said that the death of those Palestinians were not normal. Two of those who had been killed behind bars were from the Gaza Strip, were Palestinian workers who had been working in lands occupied in 1948, and then with the start of the war on the Gaza Strip, they had been sent to the occupied West Bank. However, they were detained like thousands of Palestinians here, and of course, they had been tortured. We are speaking about young Palestinians. We are not speaking about elderly that at the end of the day, the Israelis can say that they were sick or ill. They were young Palestinians in the 30s or 40s, and it's accurate. Obviously, it's clear that they had been tortured and mistreated by the Israelis. So five Palestinian prisoners were murdered behind bars, and at least one of them, his identity had not been revealed by the Israeli soldiers.
Thank you, Mona Candil, there joining us from Ramallah. Professor Saad Nimr, also joining us from Ramallah. Thank you for your patience, Professor Nimr. And you and Mona, both of you are out of occupied Ramallah, probably much better informed than we are about the Israeli crackdown on Palestinians there in the occupied West Bank over the last 43 days. Your initial thoughts, please.
What we are witnessing since the beginning of this war, if can we call it the war, genocide against the Palestinian, is an increase and an escalation of the Israeli measures in the West Bank, in all of the areas and all districts. And it is a kind of a campaign by the Israeli military and the settlers against the Palestinians. The increase in the escalation of these atrocities against the Palestinians are really unprecedented. What we are witnessing, more than 200 Palestinians were killed within these 40 days. We are talking about around 3,000 Palestinians were detained. We are talking about houses which was demolished. We are talking about grabbing of land and also displacing of Palestinian communities by the settlers. So there is a campaign against the Palestinians. It's a kind of, I don't think that there is a kind of a a target, a real target for the Israeli, apart from expressing their hatred and their real face, you know, against the Palestinians. It is a kind of revenge for the Palestinians for what happened in Gaza on the 7th of October. So nowadays it's really very, very bad. And even the worse, that's cutting off the and sieging the cities and the villages from each other. Already we are talking about over 800 roadblocks it exists in the West Bank, in addition to other roadblocks which was implemented after this war. Now they are cutting off all cities from each other and the cities from the villages, and this affecting the Palestinians really in a hard way, because now, for instance, the Minister of Education declared that the education for children will be online because teachers can't reach their schools, nor children can reach also their schools sometimes. So, and because of the incursions and the attacks for the cities, even children are not safe. So they have to go for the online teaching. It means that cutting off cities from each other, that now each city on its own, and it's the villages are also isolated, and that will affect the Palestinian directly, not only by the killing and the arresting, but also economically, as well as connection between the Palestinians.
Thank you, Professor. Always a pleasure to check in with you. Do stay safe till we speak again. I appreciate your presence here on the program. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science, joining us from Brzezet University out of occupied Ramallah. That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime siege paralyzes civil defense teams and cuts off people from each other, leaving many worried about the fate of their families in the Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Gaza photographer Maha Al-Astal is inundated with pleas from people whose loved ones in Gaza are missing or feared killed in the Zionist regime's airstrikes. She told Middle East Eye, they implore me and others with a large social media following to relay their messages to those who remain in northern Gaza to join their rescue efforts. They send us desperate requests to share their stories on social media platforms. In the midst of intense Israeli regime airstrikes, the disruption of mobile networks and the severe reduction of telecommunication signals along the primary routes, as reported by Palestinian telecoms provider Paltel multiple times during October and November, have undermined rescue efforts in Gaza.
Samir Al-Khatib, the deputy director of Gaza Civil Defense, told Middle East Eye that the interruption of telecommunication services has disconnected them from those seeking help. The previously available free hotline for the civil defense has been halted. As a result, they now have to rely on hearing explosions from various locations to determine where to respond. Additionally, they depend on pleas from individuals who approach them and provide a specific location information. Fast communication during bombings plays a vital role in saving the victims, but the Zionist regime has halted it. Al-Astal, who has 90,000 followers on Instagram, is among many Palestinian social media users and influencers who are frequently approached by those seeking to locate missing people in the densely populated Gaza Strip, which has been under daily bombardment for 38 days, with most casualties killed in bombardments of homes, hospitals, and other civilian infrastructure. Maha feels she has a duty to rely these voices, utilizing her wide reach. She said, "I wish I could do anything else. I pray for their safety." In one Instagram post, she published a call for help by a Palestinian woman who has said her husband and family were trapped in a residential building that was under Israeli regime airstrikes and was being besieged by tanks. According to the woman, they contacted the International Committee of the Red Cross officials but had not received a response. Likewise, Noor Sorki, a local journalist now based in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza after leaving the north with her family, has only been sharing numerous appeals from individuals in distress. One of the pleas was regarding her cousin who went missing in Gaza. "I don't know what happened to him. I shared his story. The last information we have is that he went outside in search of clean water for his brother who is suffering from kidney failure," she said. She added that in addition to social media, people often direct their pleas to the International Red Crescent Committee, whom they believe to be responsible or present in the region. Those based abroad are also joining efforts to amplify the calls for help on their social media pages. Palestinian social media user Dima Khayal, a sales and marketing professional based in Turkey with more than 13,000 followers, said she receives many messages on Facebook asking for help. Most of her followers are from Gaza, she said. "I receive dozens of pleas every day. Regrettably, within the plethora of published appeals, few receive any help from ICRC or civil defense or ambulance services. It's almost impossible to reach the bombed areas. Everyone keeps telling me the situation is dire." Prior to the war, the 32-year-old Khayal managed a Facebook group with over 200,000 subscribers from the Gaza Strip, focusing on providing information and guidance to travelers, whether they are departing from or returning to Gaza. "We used to assist Gaza students in expediting their departure from the Gaza Strip by communicating with the crossing authorities. We used to bring those unavailable medications from Egypt to Gaza. Now the group is filled with pleas for people trapped under the rubble and pleas for humanitarian assistance," she said. While Hayal lives in Turkey along with her mother and sister, many of her uncles and extended relatives are still in northern Gaza, where the fierce ground battles and bombardment are taking place. She told Middle East Eye, "I would like to help them. I would like to make their voices heard. But unfortunately, we cannot do anything in this situation. Of course, it is a very difficult feeling. Imagine that I received a plea that there were more than 7 families bombed in Rimal neighborhood, and no one was able to help them. An elderly woman who was killed in the same area, and a girl who was wounded and bled to death in the street." Yara Aid, a Palestinian journalist based in the UK, has also been sharing similar pleas. Recently, as Israeli regime forces besieged Al-Shifa Hospital in the northern part of Gaza, she posted on X calling for help for her friend and his family of 13 people stranded in the fighting. She said tearfully, "I'm calling the international community, please do something. My friend and his family are stuck next to a house that got bombed. They're unable to move. The Israeli regime tanks are there. They're unable to do anything. They are civilians. They are innocent. 13 people with their children. Their dad got a stroke and they cannot move. Please, guys, share this. Please, please." Aya Abu Habal was among those who used social media to look for a missing family. When an Israeli regime airstrike hit a home where her husband, Ahmad, was sheltering in Gaza City on October 25th, she took to Facebook to post a plea for help to locate her husband, but it was too late. When civil defense services and firefighters arrived at the scene, they were able to rescue a few people from the rubble, she said, but then they had to move to another bombed area to assist with rescue efforts there, as the survival rates were expected to be higher. Her father-in-law rushed to the scene to try to excavate the body of his son. He told the Middle East Eye, "There is no hope now. The Israeli rocket leveled the tower."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Over the past 75 years of the occupation of the Palestinian territories, the Israeli regime, thanks to the biased coverage of the Western mainstream media, has been using propaganda and disinformation to justify its atrocities against the people of Palestine. In the ongoing war on Gaza, Israel has once again used similar methods, which are seen as the Israelis trying to play the victim card and legitimize the genocide in Gaza. It seems that the Israeli regime is losing the narrative on Gaza, given the mounting global support for the Palestinians and anti-Israel campaigns, both on the streets and in social media as well. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have Lee Zangler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal. And also spokesperson of the Masar Baril movement, Mr. Khalid Barakat, joining us from Vancouver. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Angler in Montreal. Given the increased level of support that we're seeing out on the streets for the Palestinian cause and the opposition to the Israeli war, Mr. Angler, would you say that the Israelis have lost in the court of public opinion?
They've been very damaged in the court of public opinion. There is clearly millions and millions of people here in Canada and tens, hundreds of millions of people around the world who no longer believe their their claims, their propaganda. Whether they've lost, I wouldn't go so far as to say that for certain. Having the backing of the U.S. empire and having the backing of the biggest media outlets in North America is very powerful friends in your corner. But it's been incredibly damaged. I think there's, for anyone who's somewhat progressive, there's probably no going back. Increasingly, support for Israel is something that you find among the more right wing, the more openly pro-imperial, pro-empire factions of Canadian, U.S. Political life. And that is probably that's never going to change. And that process has been going on for years now. And it's been accelerated rapidly with the incredible level of violence and horrors that Israel's committed against Palestinians in Gaza.
Let's see what Mr. Barakat has to say about that. Sir, I phrased it as the Israelis losing in the court of public opinion. I want to get your thoughts on that as well, given the increased level of global awareness, the worldwide support for Palestinians, the opposition to the Israeli war. And let's not forget all that's been happening with regards to the online and social media propaganda with the Israelis. They come up with stories, they post videos, and then they have to retract them and delete those videos. Give us your thoughts, please.
Well, if we're talking about public opinion worldwide, I think that Palestinians have always won in that arena. But if we are talking about in the West, particularly because that's the real fight on public opinion in the Western world, and particularly in places like the United States, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, and so on and so forth. And on that level, I think that in certain areas, Palestinians have definitely won that public opinion, especially in places like Canada. For example, 3 out of 4 Canadians think that there should be a ceasefire, and many of them view what's happening as an Israeli aggression. I do agree with Eve on that a great damage has happened to Israel narrative and the Zionist narrative in terms of, the support of Israel, even particularly amongst the younger generation, where we see more support of the Palestinian people, right, Palestinian resistance. And that includes the many young people from Jewish backgrounds who now are more daring in expressing their support for the Palestinian people. So I think it is definitely a qualitative step towards, a decisive victory in terms of public opinion for Palestine.
Mr. Engler, looking at what's taking place online, what many would be calling the online propaganda efforts by the Israelis, where they try to portray themselves as the victims and trying to justify the war crimes that they're committing against Palestinians in Gaza. There was a report, an analysis, basically, by a company which was, in fact, pro-Israeli, that around 7 billion posts were pro-Israeli, with pro-Israeli tags, were published on Instagram and TikTok since October 7th, compared to 109 billion posts with pro-Palestinian tags. So that speaks volumes in itself. Break that down for us, please.
Yeah, and I bet you a lot of the pro-Israel posts are indirectly or directly paid for by the Israeli government or their lobby groups.
Sure.
So that those numbers would be even more skewed, if not... I think that has an age component to it. It's very clear that that the younger generation, I've even seen that myself. I'm 20 years out of university, and there was big battles on Palestine when I was at university 20 years ago. Now the pro-Israel crowd is completely unable to engage in any sort of democratic process at the university level. So for instance, the Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at McGill University has a resolution that their students are voting on right now, the anti-genocide and Palestine resolution. And the Israel supporters on campus won't even engage in the referendum. All they're doing is calling on the university administration to just ban the referendum, and the university administration to put pressure on the student union that if they accept this referendum, that they will lose their funding. So they know that among 20-year-olds, they can't win any kind of like voting process. And I think that's somewhat what we're seeing reflected on the social media platforms that are particularly used by younger people, is that they don't like seeing Palestinian babies being killed by Israel and Gaza, and they don't have this baggage of I don't know, we call it the legacy of the Nazi Holocaust. They are more multiracial. They're not as inclined towards believing that white Europeans are the best and everything. They're always great or whatever. And so there's an obvious race dynamic to this conflict, and young inclined to believe that sort of imperial colonial ideology. So the Israel lobby people, they know it. They're scared. They don't know what to do. If you looked at that recent Israel rally in Washington D.C., they were paying students $250 to attend to attend the demonstration. And obviously the Palestine Solidarity, the anti-war forces don't have those resources. We have to pay out of pocket to take a bus down to the protests. But they are losing the battle. All the surveys, Khaled just pointed out, Canadian. If you look at the breaking down of Canadian public opinion by age category, you find that younger people are more likely to believe Israel is an apartheid state by large margins. They believe that Israel is an apartheid state. So that's a danger from the Israel lobby's perspective going forward. This kind of stuff is, of course, sort of existential threat going forward.
Mr. Barakat, as Mr. Engler just mentioned, more and more people are coming to the realization that the Israeli regime is an apartheid regime. And in addition to that, when we look at the mainstream media narrative that the Israelis usually have, they throw in all kinds of twists and turns to try to justify what they're doing in Gaza. They say they want to eradicate Hamas. They say they're opening humanitarian corridors, allowing people to move to the south of Gaza. Yet, we see demonstrations, for example, in Madrid, in Spain, where people took to the streets showing their support for Palestinians. They carried placards reading, "This is not a war, it's genocide." So people, in spite of all the media propaganda, all the media, the twisted media narratives, people are already recognizing this as a genocide.
Absolutely. And it's because of struggle and because of people commitment and because of many, many voices that have made this a reality, including people conscious. I mean, when they listen to the Israeli rhetoric, and Israel tried to promote itself as a victim, yet Israel have a nuclear weapon, the only country in the entire area that actually have a nuclear weapon, and now they're publicly threatening to use it, by ministers in this fascist government. So at the same time, Israel goes into this contradiction. They want to play the victim card, and they want to promote themselves as a very strong and advanced army that can, kill babies and destroy universities and hospitals and so on and so forth. So you don't really need to know so much history about the conflict in order to realize that what's happening here is a war crime and genocide. Particularly in today's age of media, and people have access to alternative narratives and media outlets. Just imagine 25 years ago, 30 years ago, in Canada, if you're just an average Canadian person who wants who reads, you know, the Globe and Mail or Vancouver Sun or, the National Post, you're pretty much getting the same story about Palestine, although there's three different newspapers, but you don't get a real alternative information. The same goes with, TV stations, radio. So where can people actually get a real information, real, facts? In today's age, I think with the world is changing, and we see that how also Palestinians are, especially in Gaza, they're very active in terms of communicating with the world, showing the world what's really happening. There are also very good writers and journalists who have access now to different media outlets. Somebody like our friends Eve here, he writes all the time about Palestine, and he have many readers, but he's not going to be welcome in the mainstream media, or the, liberal media in this country. But now we have different forms or forums in which we can hear alternative voices. And at the same time, we began to see a little bit of change in terms of school curriculum, university curriculum, especially in studies like history, anthropology, studying colonialism, studying the era of slavery. These kind of studies didn't exist, a few decades back. And now there's more of them. And so the younger generation, since high school, they're more exposed into, a more real kind of account of history. And so they come to universities these days ready to take a stand against apartheid, against colonization, against these kinds of oppression, not just in Palestine, but worldwide.
Right. And Mr. Engler, what about the hypocrisy that we're seeing, most notably in European countries, with regards to these demonstrations? For example, you can burn the Holy Quran. That's considered free speech. But if you were to burn an Israeli flag, that would be a major offense. They would arrest you. They would charge you. How do you explain that?
It's flagrant hypocrisy. We see this in Calgary here in Canada. A protest organizer was arrested for chanting "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." The Israel lobby, while they're committing genocide, they have the media talking about how some chant for equal rights is genocide. There's a whole effort to ban protests here. And as you mentioned, in Germany and in France, they've banned all kinds of Palestine solidarity protests. It's not really explainable beyond it's just serving power. It just speaks to how deferential those countries are to Israel and to the U.S. empire. All of the rhetoric in terms of the hypocrisy, all of the rhetoric about Russia violating international law and Ukraine's right to resistance and all this kind of stuff, it's all been so crassly thrown out the window. And Israel's constant violation of international law is not cited. We're not even, we should be sending, by that logic, we should be sending weapons to a Palestinian resistance if we're saying that with regards to Russia and Ukraine. But the hypocrisy is just off the charts. Obviously, also the ability to mobilize the European destruction of Jewry, the Nazi Holocaust, the ability to mobilize that on behalf of Israel's genocidal policies is pretty remarkable. So you have this incredible horror that happened in human history being used to justify this ongoing horror. So that's part of the equation here. It's so cynical to see the Israel lobby organizations do that, and so many politicians go along with that. But that's part of this ability to shut down expressions of support for the Palestinian cause here in Canada, in Europe, and elsewhere.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sure. Mr. Barakat, many officials, many diplomats from around the world have been blaming the United States and European countries for what's taking place right now. They've been many opinions have gone as far as saying that the United States is actually complicit in the war crimes that are being committed by the Israeli regime. I want to get your thoughts on how do you see, how would you rate the level of involvement of the United States when we're talking about the blood of Palestinian children? And is the scenario, the notion that the United States could actually stop the Israelis from carrying out the incessant bombings, that could happen immediately. Do you agree with that notion?
Absolutely. And I think the United States is actually leading this war crimes and genocide against the Palestinian people. They are providing Israel with military support, financial support, political cover in all international arena, adopting literally the Zionist narrative and the Israeli discourse in all levels, without any efforts to even check. And that's because the United States inherited Israel, in the region, as they inherited the British Empire of the region. And now the United States is an occupying power in the region. And that's how it is being viewed by the vast majority of the people in the region, that the United States is the leading factor in terms of wars. When we look at what happened in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in 2006, Israel did not even want to go into a massive war against Lebanon. They were viewing, they were calculating if they should do or not. But the United States and Condoleezza Rice have pushed and kept pushing to continue, not just attack Lebanon, not just destroy the Western District and, vast majority of the villages in the south, but they kept pushing Ehud Olmert then to continue his war in Lebanon. And at the end, Israel did not achieve any of its objectives. The resistance in Lebanon is 1,000 more strong than what it was in 2006. And I think that it's the same scenario happening today in Gaza, except the what happened is that Gaza have no depth. The resistance is being under siege from also Egypt, and that's why the Palestinian situation is much harder than in Lebanon. But it's the United States who is definitely doing this. And if you ask Palestinians, the vast majority of Palestinians will tell you that Israel and the United States are both leading this wars and genocide against us. And this is public. When they ask the U.S. representative in the United Nations why you did not call for a ceasefire a month ago, she said, because the resolution that was presented by Russia did not include the right of Israel to self-defense. And first of all, it's a lie. And second of all, it's they're willing to lie publicly and keep lying in order to, pressure the Palestinian people to surrender and to push Palestinian resistance to surrender. And I think Israel is going to fail in all of its objectives. The only thing that the United States and Israel not doing now is they're just killing more Palestinians, destroying more Palestinian lives and not achieving any real political objectives.
Let's get a final quick question for Mr. Engler, very briefly, if you may, sir. An analyst that we spoke to earlier here during one of our broadcasts said that one of the main problems internationally is that there's a lack of proper mechanism to solve the situation. That's, of course, alluding to the likes of the United Nations Security Council. After 42 days, the best they could come up with was just something absurd as humanitarian pauses. So talk to us about that, as if you may. Also, then there's bodies like the ICC and the ICJ, which are relatively moot, at least when it comes to the case of the Israelis at this point.
Yeah, Russia taking hundreds of Ukrainian kids to Russia led to ICC charge, Israel killing 6,000 Palestinian children in Gaza, and we haven't seen that move forward.
Right.
Yesterday here in Canada, there was a bid to, there's a serving of notice to four, the Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and two other ministers that they will be seek prosecution for their role in aiding and abetting Israel's war crimes. There's been similar efforts in other countries. So that, I know South Africa just announced that they were taking, they were calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's crimes. So those avenues definitely need to be pursued. I think they're going to be very difficult so long as the U.S. empire is bankrolling all this, providing diplomatic cover, providing, you know, pressuring international courts to the International Court, Criminal Court, and other bodies to not investigate Israel's crimes. That's going to, but I would venture to guess that Israeli politicians and military leaders are going to have a harder and harder time traveling internationally in the coming weeks and coming months and
sure.
maybe coming years.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Eve Engler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal. And thanks to Mr. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson of the Masar Battle Movement, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Sheikh Karimi to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, Sheikh Karim, during the history of Islam, we can say so many of the people paid attention to only the spiritual and the religious aspects of the life of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams. But one major question is that, did they ever work for their living and to earn the living? In fact, did they have any specific occupation or job to earn the living for the family or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sure, I mean, you cannot find any prophet and any imam without working to be able to earn money. All of them, they have been engaged in working. When it comes to our prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, when he was in the city of Mecca, for example, in one part of his life, he was working as a, tradesman. He was working for Khadija for several years. And when he migrated to the city of Medina, one of his activities was farming and agriculture. Yes. It's been mentioned in the history that the Holy Prophet, some people gave him some lands, and he was working. I mean, the Holy Prophet himself was working in these lands, to do agriculture and farming. And he has been quoted as saying that, مَا فِي الْأَعْمَالِ شَيْءٌ أَحَبُّ إِلَى اللَّهِ مِنَ الزِّرَاعَةِ. There is nothing, no work more beloved to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than agriculture and farming. وَمَا بَعَثَ اللَّهُ نَبِيًّا إِلَّا زَرَّاعًا. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not sent any prophet except that they have been engaged in this act, that is agriculture.
That's right.
They were farmers. إِلَّا إِدْرِيسَ فَإِنَّهُ كَانَ خَيَّاطًا. Except for Prophet Idris, who was a tailor. So this is a reality that the Holy Prophet also was engaged in this act. And of course, his income was also coming from two other sources.
Yes.
One of them is the spoils of war, like all the other Muslims. And of course, there is an exception, a difference here, that according to the Noble Book of Quran, the spoils of war, which were taken by Muslims without any war, it was only for the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, including Fadak, for example, and some lands of Banu Nadir. Of course, the Holy Prophet gave Fadak to Lady Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and for other lands and properties, he was giving the incomes to the Muslims.
And this has been the... We can say, that's right, the fashion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for all the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
They had a job.
Sure.
Even the prophets before Prophet Muhammad had an occupation.
All
you
of
know?
Them, yeah.
All of them
mentioned.
As a carpenter, as, for example, a farmer, as you said, as the potter.
Exactly.
You could say, and different occupations and interesting jobs for earning the living. That's
exactly.
Right.
And the other source for the Prophet is homes, and then some gifts from the people. It's been mentioned that some people, they like to give some gifts to the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. But of course, the Holy Prophet himself was also working. When it comes to Imams of the Ahl Bayt, again, we see the same reality, that the main income for the Imams of the Ahl Bayt alayhim salam was through agriculture and farming and sometimes trading. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when for 25 years he was away from the caliphate, that was usurped from him, he was engaged in agriculture and especially to cultivate palm trees.
Yes.
For 25 years, he was doing that. He used to, dig a lot of wells. And according to some historians, when it comes to properties and wealth, Imam Ali alayhi salam was absolutely a rich person, but he himself was leading a very poor life because of the fact that he was spending his wealth and properties for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, it's been mentioned in Wasail al-Shi'a, volume 12, page 22, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, through his work, the income coming from his work,
yes,
he set free 1,000 slaves.
Yes.
Of course, like any other Muslim, Imam Ali alayhi salam could take his share from Baytul Mal, from the public treasury. But it's been mentioned that, according to some narrations, that Imam Ali alayhi salam never take any money from Baytul Mal. Mm-hmm. He was just using his income from agriculture.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.